Hello and welcome to another episode of Two Pre-Sales and a Pod. And there are three of us today. So you're joined by myself, Adam Freeman, and we've got Don. Hi, Don.
Hey there. Yeah.
And we've got Tom as well. Hey, Tom.
Hiya.
So Mark Green, for those of you who have seen maybe on LinkedIn, our co-host is over in the States at the minute enjoying his new role with Consensus, their director of pre-sales. So from all, just a massive congratulations to Mark. We're missing you on the show, but you're having much more fun in the States than you are recording with us. So what are we talking about today? So we're talking about your next career step. And we want to pick this topic because of a number of stats that we found out that are going on in the industry, haven't we, Don?
Oh, yes, yes. So one of the numbers, now, the first thing with our profession, you have to kind of, we probably all understand it, is that there is no common name for it. I think we've all decided, certainly in previous episodes, pre-sales is just an umbrella term. There's very few people left who've actually got that as part of their job title. So it's always been really, really difficult to find out who's in our profession and craft. And you could, because you can't just go and have a look at LinkedIn, because you'd have a search parameter that would be about, you know, 100 characters long and still going. So we're kind of lucky that there's a couple of companies who are in the pre-sales tech stack who have done some research on this. So the first number comes from Consensus, which is they believe just in, I think it's in the USA, the Americas and EMEA, that there are 800,000 people in our profession. Okay. There's another number that I've just seen. So Viven, so that's again in our tech stack, much bigger number, 1.8 million. But interestingly, one of the things I'm always really interested in tracking, as well as saying that, that's a much bigger number, obviously. As well as saying that, they've also posted the fact that they believe on their research that there are 121,000 pre-sales jobs posted. So that'll be globally. Now, my eyebrows raised kind of somewhat into the air. I don't know, Adam, but you thought that was probably about right.
I think it's right based on just scrolling LinkedIn this morning. I feel like I scrolled past 121,000 job vacancies just this morning, right, to get between posts. But I can believe it. I think it's, like you say, it's the variations on the title. I think, you know, I've seen, you know, the titles we've spoken about at length. I think the role of what we do, I think there's been a huge demand for it. I think the way sales is going, and particularly around buyer enablement, we keep talking around this, the demand on pre-sales and the appetite for pre-sales is strong. And I think there's a lot of people starting to come into our profession. I think we are seeing new blood coming into the profession, and therefore people are opening up roles and opening up variations of roles that we haven't explored yet. I think that number's conservative, actually.
Mm. There are other numbers. I think a few months ago, John Kerr, and if you don't not connected to John Kerr, I don't know him, definite thought leader in our space, he thought there were maybe about 40,000 open roles just in the USA. So, you know, so if that's the case, it kind of all makes, it's all in the same ballpark, isn't it? So, you know, so that's a lot. And your personal experience of this, you know, speaking, because we've had previous episodes where we've had people who are recruiters in our space who've talked about this, but your personal experience of this might be that you're getting approaches, and I hear from people who've got, you know, getting three or four approaches perhaps a week, you know, some of it quite lazy, you know, in mail messaging from within LinkedIn, you know, and other things that are perhaps more direct. So, you know, so there's lots of experience. You've got probably some personal that it's a very in-demand role. And if there's 121,000 open positions right across the globe, is you might even at one level feel some pressure that I should be moving, but should you?
Let's get one thing straight. With our profession, because of the unique skill set we possess, and I do believe we have a unique skill set, actually ends up like a merry-go-round. So as the demand increases, the same pool of people pretty much are what kind of gets elevated. And so there's a certain amount of safety to our role. I do believe that. But I also believe there's always going to be demand for good people. And so when one person moves, it's invariably going to take someone else from the profession to go and fill that vacancy. That's the norm. And so there's this huge merry-go-round right now. I heard someone, I was at an external conference last week, and it was something to do with the hospitality sector. They were talking about the same stuff, right? This isn't just pre-sales. They were talking about this in hospitality particularly. And they talk about a wages spiral. And what they're seeing is that to attract the right talent, because you need a chef, well, a chef's got a certain amount of skill set that you need. Therefore, it's got to be another chef you recruit. Exactly the same as what we face. The wages are going up and up and up, and they're going up disproportionately to what the job can probably support at times. And so you end up in this wages spiral where wages go up and up and up and up and up. And in the economy, that is what kind of forces some of the inflation and some of the issues we see as well. So it's all really tied to where we are as an economy right now and the uncertainty we've got. That's a little bit of my background. I can see Tom nodding along because he's an accountant as well, but we'll not bore you with that. But I think a good place to start, and what we wanted to say was, between the three of us, we've got quite an interesting perspective on this. You've got Don, who's had numerous roles and has gone into self-employment and consultancy. But Tom, you've obviously followed a similar path to me, but, you know, come out of a professional role in accountancy and into the pre-sales profession through consulting, which is exactly the same route I took. And then I've kind of stayed at the same company a long time, and which is something you get told not to do. So we're going to try on this episode and offer you three different perspectives of options you've got. But ultimately, I think there's a lot of people we start listening to this evaluating, should I move? I've got people in my team that are moving. I mean, we were talking, Don, that's a unique problem in itself, right?
Yeah. What do you call it? FOMO, fear of missing out. Well, if they're moving, is the grass greener on, you know, somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it raises such a good question, because clearly the market is very hot at the moment for pre-sales candidates and jobs. If we're saying there's 120,000 open positions, but there's only 800,000 pre-sales people, according to consensus, maybe more according to Viven. Is that one in eight people might be moving? Or is it that pre-sales is growing dramatically? But surely it's not growing that fast. So surely it's just a lot of people moving around at the moment. And I think it's probably contributing to what you guys were saying, that spiral of wages and movement.
I'm really glad you said that. And it's almost like we planned it, which we didn't. The Viven numbers, they have got a series of numbers in front of us. And one of them pieces of research that they did was that they think there's a 6% year-on-year growth in the number of pre-sales employees. That sounds, I don't know, does that sound quite low?
6%? I think that sounds low to me.
Yeah, I'd have thought it was big. But even if it is 6% and it's 0.8 million or 1.8 million, that's a lot of people, you know, who can't not just circulate, and, you know, people who've got who are already skilled and are just moving from company to, you know, company in a similar tech segment. That's a whole load of people who are new entrants who have to come in.
So I've got to ask a question here, and I'm going to sound really stupid. Does that mean there's loads more customers out there? Because if there's loads more pre-sales people, does that mean more people are just buying software?
Ooh.
There must be more opportunity out there. I mean, that's probably a different topic, but it's got me thinking there. Is it that we're having more and more pre-sales people on an individual deal is probably my question here.
Or is it that actually our role is just growing? Because before you might have just had people doing demos, but now you've got people, if you're going towards a video strategy in pre-sales, you might have additional people in your team who are now creating videos, or sort of like these technical account managers that we've seen. Which is it sales, is it pre-sales? I think that the role is becoming very, very broad, and Don, as you mentioned at the beginning, it's so hard to give everyone one single name, so surely that's got to be contributing to it, in my opinion.
Don, in terms of career, right, I'm going to ask you a question normally asked of, normally people say, what's your best career move? I'm going to ask you the opposite. What's the worst move you've ever made in your career? Let's learn from our errors first, right?
Yeah. Now, can I go to precursor this with, because I had to have a real good think about this, because one of the things with having LinkedIn is that I shouldn't use the word stalk, because stalking is obviously a very negative word, but that's kind of, there's a lot of stalking going on of what, you know, what it's on your LinkedIn profile. So I'll have to kind of keep some of this slightly anonymous, but having been in the profession for such a long time, some of the stories I can tell you are companies who no longer exist anyway, and it was so long ago. So I was particularly thinking about two experiences. One of them is a lesson in what are the real reasons that you're moving from one role to another. So this is a bit of an emotional story. This, I actually moved companies once, because what happened was I worked for a very small company, about 10 of us, And two of the employees were in a car, and it was a car crash. And it was really bad. One of them actually died, and the other person had quite severe life-changing injuries. And actually, the road that they had the accident on was a road I commuted on. And we were all grieving. It was terrible for us. We're a really small company, kind of like a family kind of thing. And I left because I was almost part of the grieving process. And it was a huge mistake leaving because I didn't really put that much thought into where I was going to go next. It was almost, I have to leave this place, I have to go. So I was doing it for the wrong reasons. And where I went, I knew, I regretted it the very first day I went there. I went into really what turned out to be a much more junior role, even though it was sold to me as being kind of equivalent to what I was doing. And I was only there 4 weeks. And unfortunately, that caused them, that employer, a lot of problems because it was there 4 weeks. They'd made a lot of promises on my behalf with their clients of what I was going to do for them. And I actually went back to where I'd come from. But we'd sorted, in the meantime, we'd sorted a lot of things out about, you know, I didn't want to commute on that route. So they actually leased me a house, would you believe? But so I learned there's a lot of story to that. But the thing in the middle of it all is, do it for the right reasons, but if you're going to move, is that don't let it be like an emotional thing. You know, be very rational about the reasons why you're going to move.
I think, I mean, it's a powerful story and quite unique. And I, God forbid, anybody on this listening to the podcast can resonate with that, because that must be an incredibly horrific thing to go through. But it raises a really good point, actually, that you were just saying there. And I don't know if you realize you said it, where you're almost over-promised in your next step. And I think when you're getting into a situation like we are now, where there's such a demand for great people as well, where there's such a demand for great people, there is a tendency. I've spoken to a lot of candidates recently. I've got open vacancies, FYI, go to our careers website, drop me a line, happily to have you talk to you. But I've spoken to a lot of candidates.
Please.
You can't quite see how much I'm holding my hands together. But in all seriousness, I talk to candidates, and I'll talk to them where they're talking to other people, and I can tell that they're getting over-promised on a role. You know, oh, you'll be leadership, and there's a pathway to do this. And people are promising things they can't deliver on because there's a level of desperation on some people to get people in. I mean, that's where I'll go and try and pull people from industry or pull people from different backgrounds, which obviously we'll talk about in a minute, Tom. But you've got to look outside, because actually you're not, as a leader, I'm not doing that candidate the right thing to do, to promise things that I know we can't deliver on. That's not something I want to put my name against. So be really careful as a candidate that you do query if something is too good to be true. I think that's fair.
I know I'm a bit older than everyone else here, probably like another two generations, but and I'm not, what's the expression? I'm not down with the kids anymore, if people even use that. But but what you were talking about there, is that called breadcrumbing?
I don't know.
Promise. Is it?
It sounds like it should be. It sounds a great tip. Should we just create it if it's not? Right, breadcrumbing. Yeah.
I've never heard it, but it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
You know, just kind of like, here's some little breadcrumbs, you know, like, you know, this is what, don't worry, you'll get this, you'll achieve, you know, basically that's over-promising, isn't it?
Right.
You know, you get all these things without perhaps the, you know, the intention to actually make them.
But you experienced it, right? I mean, it happened to you, it happens. And I've interviewed candidates where, you know, where you'll see them maybe jump in a couple of roles because it happens, they can't spot it. And then it's your CV. And the first thing you look for is like, well, why did you only stay there 6-8 months or a year or whatever? Because that's not typical for a pre-sales role. That's, you know, might be maybe with our sales counterparts where they might move more often, that's fine. But the pre-sales person, that's not typical. And so you've got to be really conscious where you attach your personal brand. You're attaching that to an organization. We talk about that a lot. You really need to do your due diligence on that role. And where you've got two roles that are both paying good money, like Don said, move for the right reasons. That's one thing. If you are going to move for the right, but also don't, sometimes moving is the wrong thing to do. Yeah. You know, sometimes you're so much better. I've stayed where I am. This is my 11th year. And I've had people in my career, right? I'm going to call this out. I have people in my career who've said, you know what, to get taken seriously, you need to move. Why do I need to move? You know, we've gone from a £10 million organization to £600 million. It's a completely different beast every few years, right? I know that's not typical. I get that. And I get, I'm very fortunate to work in a business like that. But I've still got the same name on my LinkedIn, you know, employment list for the same 11 years, and you see people, you know, at some of the largest tech companies have been there decades. That doesn't mean that they aren't able to go somewhere else and be successful. What they've done is reinvent themselves and create a career there. So please don't feel that you have to move to get ahead. I haven't. But sometimes there are legitimate reasons for moving, aren't there? And I think that's what you're saying, Don, isn't it? If you're going to move, make sure it is for the right reasons and not just a little bit more money, because that doesn't get you far.
And also, just to add to that, Adam, I mean, you've been in your company for 11 years, but you've not been doing the same role for 11 years, right?
No.
And I think that's the key, because if you can stay, and I'm speaking from my own experience, if you can stay in the same company but move into a different role. I went from being an individual contributor towards doing sort of project-based stuff. We implemented a new tool and we designed how the way in which pre-sales worked. But I found that not so difficult because I had my internal network. I knew who to go to help get things done. Whereas if I had have gone into a different role in a different company, suddenly you don't know the culture of that organization. You don't know all of those people in your internal network that are probably going to make your life really easy. So I think that it's really important to consider, could I do this different role but in my own organization? Absolutely. Or do I really have to go to a new company? I think that's something to bear in mind.
I mean, a couple of things there. One is, I mean, I was 11 years. It's funny that, but talk about 11 years, it's the same thing. I was 11 years at SAP and had three very, very different roles, you know, very different levels of responsibility and doing very different things. And the third role, you know, the role grew with, it was kind of like a nothing role to start with. Is like you had to create everything, you know, like a regional structure and organization and operations and things, because there was nothing there at all. And kind of create it from scratch for an organization that was, you know, at one point over 1,000 people. So, you know, you very rarely get opportunities to do things like that, but I already would have done that by, you know, they wouldn't probably take in anyone from outside. It had to be someone from inside the organization who could, you know, could already have some level of credibility internally and also already had a network, an internal network. You know, so that was one thing there. I also wanted to go back to something Adam said earlier about, you know, if you're leaving, if you're moving jobs every kind of 6 to 8 months, there's some research that's just come out in the last few weeks from Consensus. And that's their 2022 kind of SE workload and compensation report. And in there, it says they had 700 responses from kind of pre-sales individual contributors and leaders. And the average onboarding time for a pre-sales person is 6 months. But in over a quarter of cases, it's kind of 7 months and a lot more. So going back to what Adam said, is it if you've left, you know, after kind of 6 months or 8 months or whatever, you didn't even really finish onboarding in a lot of cases. But, and the whole point of onboarding is you get to a point where you become, you're now an effective revenue influencer.
Yeah.
And so you haven't even proved that you can do the job if you've left, you know, let's say, you know, 12 months, kind of 14 months. And, you know, so you've got to be careful of that, because the next employer, they know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's the key. And what I'd also call out, by the way, if your onboarding's at 7 months, like, you need to do some work on that, because that's not great. Okay, that's 7 months of, as salaries get higher, that cost of onboarding, that ramp, that cost to serve is getting higher. One of the things I focused on, just as a side note, on the last 6 months is bringing my onboarding time right down, because every area of the business, finding people, and that's changed my hiring strategy, actually. Because it's sometimes quicker to teach the pre-sales element than it is to teach an existing pre-sales person a whole new product or a new industry. And that has changed my hiring strategy. So I would say, if you're a leader listening to this, where leaders are stuck to get existing pre-sales people, and if you're in this listening to this and you're actively interviewing this week and you're out and about, which there will be really careful you don't price yourself out of a move, because I've seen that as well recently.
Yeah. Originally, Adam asked me about, you know, experience moving a role and it being the wrong thing to do. So I mentioned one of them. It was obviously a very emotional experience, that one. But there is a second occasion when I moved and I knew immediately I'd done the wrong thing. And I think the best way of explaining that was that I was just flattered. I let flattery kind of take over, as in, wow, this company are interested in employing me. And it was all reflecting on the, you know, the interviewing and, you know, the actual kind of acquiring, as it were, process. I'm not sure I asked all that many questions. I was just kind of dumbfounded and flattered that this company were interested in me. And I won't mention what the name of it is, the company, but again, I knew pretty much on the first day that I landed that I shouldn't have done this. It was the wrong thing to do. And I felt really, really bad about it, but and wanted to give back. I knew I wasn't going to stay there long already, but I wanted to kind of give back some value, you know, because it costs a lot of money in the kind of talent acquisition. And I wanted to try and give something back. But I already, you know, and it's a mindset as well. If you've already joined a job and know that I'm not going to stay here very long, that's quite a negative mindset to kind of like have. And you've got to be really careful you don't infect everyone else around you with it. Yeah. So, yes, yeah, so don't move for that reason either as well. It's all back to the same thing. You know, be very rational about why you're making that decision and about that you can't just kind of leave because it's going to leave a, you know, going to be make a big hole in your CV.
I mean, I think that's absolutely perfect. And I think it leads me to think about kind of what I know of your background, Tom. You know, I think we've always got on because we've got a really similar background and a similar kind of desire of why to be in pre-sales. And I know in our podcast and our audience, not only do we have a lot of different nationalities, we have a lot of different current roles, and we have a lot of people from backgrounds where they're in a profession or maybe in customer success or something outside of pre-sales, and they're thinking, well, is now the right time to come in and why? So if I take you back to when you have made a difficult decision as I did, at some point you were getting your council qualifications and you decided this isn't for me. What led you to not only jump industries, but then make the right choice of who to jump with?
So I was working for a large FMCG in accounting, right? And I studied accounting at university and I enjoyed studying accounting. But then when I actually got there, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the technical side of it, but it was very, you know, sitting at a desk, you didn't talk to many people. And that was my first job out of university. And I remember my boss basically saying, right, you need to set your goals for the year. And I wanted one of my goals to be, I want to do presentations. How can I get experience presenting to people? And he literally had to tell me, like, Tom, you're an accountant. You're not going to do presentations because that's just not part of what we do. And it was at that time, it was at that point that I really realized this isn't for me. I want to be standing up. I want to be talking to people. I don't want to be sitting in silence at a desk. But I was always good at, you know, doing macros on Excel and doing technical side to try and automate my role as much as possible so I could spend as little time as possible doing it, really. And that's what led me into like tech consulting, because I knew that I was okay with technology. But also I was promised this opportunity to be able to talk to customers, talk to clients, present to them here and there. But it was a pure consulting role. So I'm convinced that I absolutely moved there for the right reasons. Because I always knew I liked performing. And actually, like you, Don, I've always played loads of music. So all through my childhood, my early 20s, I was playing so much music. I loved standing on a stage. And I think a lot of the joy you get out of that and probably some of the skill set, it's very similar between presenting and performing music. I think a presentation is a performance, right? But it's when I got into the consulting, I loved it. I loved solving technical problems. I didn't even know what pre-sales was at that point until I saw some people doing it. And I got my first exposure into pre-sales. And suddenly I realized I could be presenting every day rather than doing a massive 6-month project and doing a small presentation at the end, because that was really what I enjoyed as opposed to all the technical stuff that I was doing in it. So I think sort of moving from accounting into consulting and then moving from consulting into pre-sales, I always felt like it was for the right reasons, less so about the company that I was working for, but I really knew what I really enjoyed in my day-to-day and how could I do more of that, basically.
And I'm listening to that story. Not once did I hear I moved for money.
No, no way.
And we've got to remember that that sense of fulfillment in our career comes from more than money. It's purpose. It's what you get out of your role. It's The Japanese call it ikigai, I think is the right term, if anyone's come across that. I will put something on my LinkedIn about that, because I think you've just hit the nail on the head. There's this idea that there's things in the world you can be paid to do. There's things in the world that you love doing. There's things in the world that people need. And then there's things that you're good at. And where that overlaps, that's where you find your purpose. That's where you get fulfillment. That's the idea. And when you start to move for money, or you move towards one of those axes, those extremes, you don't get a sense of fulfillment. And that's why people often jump and move. And a couple of people I've mentored, I've always asked them to position themselves on that axis. So that gives you a really good handle. And I'd encourage anyone listening to do that as well. So, you know, I'll just repeat those really, really quickly. So things you can be paid for, things that you love doing and like doing, things that the world needs from people, and things that you're good at. Just plot yourself on that axis, you know, on a 1 to 4 on each of them, and just see where you land. Because if it's roughly near the middle, you're doing the right thing. All right, you're doing exactly the right thing. If you are getting a lot of money, but you don't like your role, do you know what? You probably need to move. And just be really rational about it. Don't sometimes sit and do that before you decide if you're going to leave. Because one of the things I said before we started recording was, some people leave a role because they get a new role propositioned. They were never going to leave unless that got propositioned. So you must be getting a sense of fulfillment. So think about, the grass is not always greener is the most true statement that's ever been said about this situation. You know, if someone's left that role that you're going to fill, ask why, because you're probably going to experience something similar. If it's growth, great. But then you want to be worried about, are you growing faster than you can recruit? There's always a challenge when you move. Okay. And if you're inheriting a big role and it's a promotion, it's probably because someone else has done a really bad job of it and you've got to pick that culture up. So just be mindful on every career step. Sometimes you are absolutely, like I have, better staying where you are, all right? It is true.
Tell you what, those four categories you just gave, I've not heard those before. I'm sure I've sort of gone through those, you know, in a roundabout way in my head, but distilling those out into four categories that people can really think about when moving roles, I think that's so valuable.
I'll put it on my LinkedIn, and what I'll do is I'll put it on the podcast LinkedIn as well as a separate thing, because I think a lot of people could get a lot of value from this right now. I think we need a bit of clarity in where we are with the market. I think there's so much that I think you hit the nail on the head, Don, about when one person moves in a team, oh my God, I need to move and I need to go and someone's getting something I'm not. It's not about that. It's about you as a person.
So one of the things, I'm just conscious of time, one of the things just before we hit record we were talking about was that I've probably not really talked before on the podcast things about one of the options that you might have, which is what I did, which is to go out on your own. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, a few kind of reflections on that, because that's a hugely scary thing to do. And you've got to have a lot of trust that you can do something that is of value and people will pay for.
Well, and that's again those four axes, right?
Yep.
You know,
yeah, something that I mean, you're trading things for, you know, you're trading a kind of reliable, predictable you know, kind of wage thing for something. What are you trading it for? Autonomy, I suppose. Autonomy, you know, is, you know, I get to kind of choose what I want to do. But there's a few things and the other thing that's going on with our profession at the moment is that as it's grown, I've noticed as well in the last couple of years that there are actually quite a few more people who not towards, you know, the more mature end of the career, but even mid-career, who've kind of decided now is a good time to kind of, you know, spark off on their own. And there are a few who've kind of moved into the consultancy space, especially in the USA, which is great. But the other thing that's driving that thought about going off on my own is really the growth in the pre-sales tech stack, because there's you know, I know some people have talked about there are at least 19 products out there that have, you know, really just come in the last couple of years that are fitting into that. And that's an opportunity, you know, if you've come from a pre-sales background, is, you know, is how these tools, you know, could be used, you know, consulting on them, or even if you want to create something, you're creating them from scratch, that kind of thing. So but one of the things I would say about if you're going to go off on your own is, again, be very, very rational about it. Don't do it just because you absolutely hate working for who you are. That's not the good reason at all. And whenever anyone asks me this kind of privately about, you know, going off on your own, one of the things I would say about it is you might need somewhere between 6 months and a year's worth of money to do up front So you need to kind of save to do this, because you're not going to, unless you've been very lucky, you're not going to get a kind of reliable revenue earner straight away, because you've got to build your brand. You know, you're going out on your own. You know, if you've been lucky and you've been building your name and you've been doing a side gig, you've been doing this as a side gig and working your way towards it, which
side
is kind of
hustle.
A bit dangerous.
Side hustle, that's the word.
A side hustle. That's it. Which is good. But a side hustle is very different from the scariness of running your own business. And as soon as you do it as well, you've got to remember that now you've got to do all the different roles. You're now the salesperson. You know, you've got to handle all the finance. And there's a lot. I mean, some of the things I used to hate doing, like I hate selling. I'll do anything other than having to sell, but you're going to have to do that. But, you know, there are going to be more openings for that as we have more of the gig economy. That kind of goes there, you know, for things like in my area, like enablement, it's quite possible that it's difficult for, you know, let's say large pre-sales organizations to get to recruit lots of kind of enablement people, and they're going to rely on people on the outside. The other thing you have to take into account as well, I always recommend to people that you probably have something, maybe three or different or four different revenue streams. Is it do not rely, go out there and go, well, I'll do this and that'll make me all the money. A much more sensible way of doing it is have multiple partnerships with different people where you're kind of doing different things where you can help each other out in different ways. Because you can't always rely on one thing, always having a, you know, consistent revenue stream. Remember, this is very, if you're going to go out on your own, it's very different from kind of working from a company who are, you know, protecting you from, you know, the vagaries of, you know, winning business and even getting people to pay you. Once you've won it, because you're now a supplier to large companies who, you know, who have tend to have, you know, some of them 45, 60 day payment terms. And I don't care that you're a small company, you have to take that, and you're going to have to start dealing with procurement as well. So to draw on all of that is, it's a brilliant thing to do, gives you all this autonomy. I can kind of be very creative in what I do, but it's also quite scary. And you've got to do this with your eyes open. That, you know, you're going to have to cut lots of different strands of things to be successful.
I think the really interesting things, I'm sort of thinking, all three of us have got fairly different employment histories in terms of where we've ended up and how we've got here. But we've all got to a place where I'd like to think we're able to build our personal brand. And I think the real important thing is that you put yourself in a position where you feel empowered to do that, and you feel that you're an employer where you're getting a smile put on your face. I think that's the most important thing. The world's a pretty tough place right now. I will call that out. I think it's something I wanted to call out at some point. I think sometimes when there's a lot of change or volatility in the world, we look for, well, it must be something. It must be something that's in my sphere that I can change and control and give myself that happiness. The world is tough right now, and it's probably not your job that's making you unhappy. It's probably everything else going on around it. So as I keep saying, stop watching the news. Okay, like that'll help. You know, get yourself in a happy place, but don't just assume that jumping jobs is the right thing to do because you see other people doing it. Don't think it's the right thing to do. So let me tell people, right, this market will settle down. Okay. The last thing you want to do is end up in a role where you are overpaid for the skill set in terms of the value you can deliver. I do believe there are people buying employees right now, almost in like a football transfer type style arrangement that's going on. It's a skill set in demand. I think the demand will always be there. It's great for our profession, but I don't think it will be necessarily as buoyant as it is right now. Once everybody who was ever going to move has moved, you're left with people you cannot move. And so we're going to have to find new ways of bringing talent into the profession. So be really careful that you don't move somewhere you're going to regret. First things first, decide if you're in the right role or not. That's the first thing. Get some career counseling, reach out, get a mentor, get a mini board of directors, get whatever you need to get an outside in perspective, but make the decision of, am I in the right place to achieve the goals and what are my goals? And if you're not, cool. Like, get some advice, move. We know great people you can connect with. If you are, stick it out. And if you think, I'm not hitting my goals, but I'm in the right place, have a conversation with someone, because it's probably all really solvable. So, I mean, like I said, we've all taken completely different approaches to get here. We're all sat here with a smile on our face. We're very, very lucky. I think we're very fortunate to have the careers we have. I think I am incredibly blessed to have the career I've had and I'm having. But that's because I'm at the right employer with the right skill set that shares my values. So it's not about money, you know?
I just wanted to add, I know I've told you some shockers about career moves earlier. I didn't want people to kind of leave this and go, oh dear, that didn't, you know, his career's been a disaster. 98% of the career moves I've done have been the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, they kind of introduced me to whole new worlds, you know, whole new types of learning I would never, ever have been able to do. You know, certainly the large, when you, you know, the larger companies, you know, you kind of you meet some unbelievably clever people who create some amazing content, who are really inspirational. And they don't have to be in large companies; they can be everywhere. It's that that can be one of the best reasons to move. It's not the money; it's the chance to kind of learn from those kind of people. You know, because our job is always going to be a lifelong learning job, and if you can find someone to learn from that and inspires you, that's a, probably a brilliant reason to move.
100%. So with that, I think we'll wrap this up. There's loads more we could talk about. There's loads of meander through there. Hopefully this is the podcast someone out there needed to listen to right now, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people in, you know, in conflict with themselves about what they should do. And sometimes just getting told what you're doing is more than enough. Okay. So, you know, put a smile on your face, enjoy your role, evaluate it. Like I say, we'll share that, that Ikigai concept. But I think map yourself. I think that's a really good place to start in terms of what am I missing? Because that's somewhat hard to quantify. And as always, if you find in the world a bit of a tough place, right, just reach out. We're always here. I've had a couple of people over the last couple of weeks message, actually. That offer is always open from all of us. So please do. But with that, I think we'll wrap up. So thanks a lot, gents, and good to speak to you.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.